You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Leaders in the city of Graz are so stunned, they don't know quite how to react.
School shootings in this capacity have never been seen in Austria.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll have the latest from Austria. And people in the capital city of Ukraine last night were hit by yet another major Russian attack.
Yeah, that's one of the worst nights for the last 4 years.
The city of Paris is working on a new cooling system to deal with rising temperatures. And we've got a reality check on President Trump's promise to carry out mass deportations.
The deportation machinery has not stopped in the month of May and into June.
And a different, joyful way to commute to work by floating down a river.
It's easy, it's free, and it's really refreshing.
All those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Marco Werman is away today. Americans are all too familiar with the shock and grief of a school shooting, but they are rare in most countries. And in Austria, the city of Graz is dealing with the fallout today after a rare shooting spree at a school this morning killed at least 11 people, including the main suspect. He reportedly took his own life following the attack. It's believed to be the worst school shooting in Austria's history. Chancellor Christian Stocker called for a national day of mourning.
Eine Schule ist mehr als nur ein Ort des Lernens.
A school is more than a place of learning, he said. It's also a place of trust, security, and the future. Austria's interior minister, who was standing next to Stocker, could be seen wiping away tears. Earlier today, I spoke to Martina Marx. She reports on the Graz region for the Austrian newspaper Kleine Zeitung.
The police got notifications right around 10 a.m. that there was shots heard at the school near the main train station in Graz. And they rushed there, and there was a shooter in a classroom. And it appears that the shooter was a former pupil of the school, 21 years old, male, as I said, from the area around Graz.
I would assume nothing is known yet about the motivation, why this happened?
The police gave a very brief statement in the afternoon. There is media reports that he seems to have been a victim of bullying, but the police hasn't confirmed that, so that's speculation.
Okay. In the hours since the attack, what has the reaction been there in Graz? What are people saying and talking about?
Well, it's shock, obviously. You have to know that school shootings in this capacity have never been seen in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
We had some, but not with this number of victims. There were one or two victims and years apart from each other. So you saw it even in the faces of the politicians giving the statements in the afternoon. There was really shock, and apparently they didn't even know how to react and had tears in their eyes while they were giving their statements.
Mm. I understand that you live in Graz. You have a daughter in the schools there. Do schools there go through drills for what we call active shooter scenarios like we have here in the U.S.?
No. There are plans that, you know, get circulated from the school to the parents. If this and that happen in an emergency, we will act like that. But there are no school drills as you know them in the U.S.
Do a lot of people own guns in Austria?
There are quite a few people who own guns, but we have very tight restrictions of who is allowed to carry a weapon. And it's not like in the U.S. that you see people openly wearing a weapon. That's not common in Austria at all. We have quite a lot of people going hunting, but also there are restrictions for how you have to conceal your weapons. You have to put them in a cupboard that you can lock up, and you're not allowed to store the key in the same room, stuff like that. And the people who are allowed to carry weapons have to go through processes every now and again to check if they're still all right to carry weapons.
So the regulations are strict. I understand that the shooter did legally purchase a handgun and a shotgun, so he was a legal owner of those?
Legally possessed two firearms, a pistol and a shotgun, apparently.
And so I know there's a lot of shock, as you said. Folks are not used to this kind of thing happening in Austria. But are there any beginnings of conversation about, I don't know, what went wrong or what could be done in the future to prevent another tragedy like this?
I think right now, as of today, the shock is, you know, in the forefront. But there have been, during the last month or so, discussions about the registrations and laws because of quite a high number of femicides we have in Austria. And there was the discussion that we should even tighten the law to carry a weapon.
So, Martina, as someone with a child in the schools in Graz, are you concerned or are you thinking about this through that lens?
I am concerned. I'm even concerned when I see the reporting in the US about a school shooting. But then you always think, well, that's not happening here. And now it has happened. So, of course, you think about if she goes to school tomorrow, what will happen to her? But I think and hope that we can learn from this and take precautions so this won't happen again.
Martina Marx reports for the Austrian national newspaper Kleine Zeitung in the city of Graz. Ukraine has been through heavy Russian aerial attacks the past 2 days. Overnight, a maternity ward in the southern city of Odessa was hit, killing at least 3 people, according to Ukrainian officials. Today, the Russian military carried out one of its largest airstrikes yet on Ukraine's capital. Air raid sirens across the country have been going off almost constantly.
Yeah, definitely. These 2 nights were something different. Even for me, like staying for 3 years in Kyiv, that was something different.
Alexander Kraev is a Ukrainian political analyst in Kyiv. He describes what the past few days have been like.
Well, it was hell on earth, basically. Kyiv is kind of specific in that because we have air raid alarms in every part of every district, so it's just impossible not to hear them in the middle of the night even. And especially it is quite interesting that I'm in that part of Kyiv which has a lot of lakes and a lot of free spaces, free forestry and etc. That are the base places for anti-air defense, basically. So you can hear all different types of anti-air defense, starting from just basic Kalashnikov machine guns and ending with more profound missile systems such as Patriot or German IRST system. So each time you're able to hear the siren, you have different options. But the basic scenario which I used last night is a so-called two-wall solution. So basically, if you are at your home and you know you lack time to get to shelter, you just get your belongings, you get your documents. If you're lucky enough, you'll get enough provision for several days, several hours, because we have those packages prepared in case of emergency, and you just get to the corridor, because you need to have at least 2 walls between yourself and the possible explosion.
Right. So I wonder how your calculations about when and whether to take shelter have changed in the 3 years since the full-scale invasion has been underway.
It became more cynical, I suppose. Unfortunately, the constant danger makes you less apt for going to the shelter. You're more, you say to yourself, you're more adaptable, you're stronger, but the situation did not change. You're just lazier to go to any underground facility. Of course, we have a lot of groups in WhatsApp and Telegram and all the other messengers that provide information from our air forces, so we know what kind of danger to anticipate. So we can differ between Shahed attack or ballistic attack, or sometimes, as it was 2 nights before that, it's a combined attack. When Russians, first of all, they sent a lot of Shahed drones, which are just barraging throughout the skies, getting our air defense busy. And amid them, they send several ballistic missiles that can nearly freely go to their destination. So basically, the idea is that you can use two-wall solution if there is only a drone attack, because mostly drones have less of a punch. They have less of a warhead with them, several dozens kilos at most. So basically, of course, they're dangerous. They're very dangerous, but not as dangerous as a missile attack.
I recall when I was reporting in Ukraine, people would you know, choose during which periods they would take warning seriously. They would, you know, listen for the air raid siren, but then not actually seek cover until they got, you know, warning from, for example, the Kyiv's mayor's office. Do you look for additional information on whether to seek shelter or not?
Well, in that regard, of course, Klitschko's announcement, our mayor's announcement, is quite important. But as I said previously, we have a lot of other channels, chats, which have the additional information from our air forces, or sometimes some of us, we have guys who are serving in air force or anti-air defense unit. So they provide some information on what is the current trajectory of what specific type of munitions is coming towards Kyiv. From the beginning of the night, they're already going to the subway. They bring their blankets, they bring their mats, they bring all their necessary belongings, and they just rest at metro, whatever the type of the alarm there, because they're just trying to protect the youngsters, they're just trying to protect themselves. So they're also strategists among us, not only the panic guys who react to different types of alarms.
You've mentioned people, you know, deciding whether and where to take shelter overnight sometimes. I'm wondering if the rhythm of daily life feels different in other ways during these periods of heavy bombardment.
If we speak about businesses, if we speak about the commute or just daily life, still a lot of people just ignore the raids, they ignore the alert, especially if it's a drone attack. It's even basically during some of the concerts, especially as a small one, even the representer or the musician who is currently performing, he's like, let me double check what type of missile is coming here. If it's a Shahed, we will continue. If not, we will proceed to shelter. And also, it's a very interesting opportunity for underground pubs, underground bars, or just basically underground restaurants, because they are themselves considered shelters. So they are the only one who can freely continue with their business and freely continue to serve their customers.
It is evening in Kyiv as we're talking to you. What's your plan for getting some sleep tonight?
I have already put my mattress in the corridor. I have stored some water, some canned food for me. Well, in case I got under the debris, I have to lay down low for several hours, maybe more. I prepared my emergency pack. So as of today, I'm staying behind two walls and praying for the best.
Alexander Kraev is a Ukrainian political analyst with the Prism think tank. He joined us from Kyiv. Some snarky comments are just timeless, like the one where someone is complaining and you pretend to play a tiny, invisible violin for them. That image has made it into TV shows as diverse as MASH and SpongeBob SquarePants.
Oh, boo-hoo! Let me play a sad song for you on the world's smallest violin. This is serious! I know! This really is the world's smallest violin! See?
Well, scientists at Loughborough University in the UK have decided to take the phrase literally.
I'm Kelly Morrison. I'm a professor of experimental physics here at Loughborough University. We've been exploring the capabilities of our new nanolithography system to create what we believe is the world's smallest violin.
That violin is made out of platinum and is just 13 microns wide. For comparison, a single human hair can be up to 180 microns in diameter.
Another comparison we can make is of the size of the violin to the size of a tardigrade, or small water bear.
Tardigrades are eight-legged creatures that can survive in the vacuum of space.
And they have a size of about 50 to 1,200 microns. So if you had a small tardigrade, they might be able to play the violin.
That's Naomi Leo, another researcher on the project, describing something that is just delightful to picture. The tiniest violin's construction was a demonstration of the lab's nanolithography technology. Here's Morrison again explaining how it works.
It's like this very, very, very small needle that can see atomic interactions. What we do is we take that needle and we heat it up. So now it can not only see the surface with atomic resolution, but it can burn away material. Because it can burn away material, we can use it to write patterns.
That teeny tiny needle was used to draw a violin into a polymer stencil. Then platinum was applied to create the violin itself and the stencil removed. This nanolithography technology isn't just because scientists are very committed to the bit. It is helping them better understand how to make smaller and more energy-efficient methods of data storage that could end up being crucial for future generations of computer chips. You're listening to The World.
Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000 and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. For a lot of us, our daily commute is pure business, and not what you would describe as fun. Hop in a car or get on a train and go from point A to point B as quickly as possible. But for a few months every year in Switzerland, people actually savor their commute to work. The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, has our story.
You'll never guess how Swiss people get home from work.
Forget briefcases. In the Swiss river cities of Bern, Basel, and Zurich, it's all about floaty bags.
When the temperatures rise, some workers let themselves be carried away by the current of the Aar, the city's main river, renowned for its purity.
The time-honored tradition of river commuting, jumping into the river and letting it carry you wherever you need to go, has been a part of daily life during Swiss summers for decades.
I did it the first time, I think, when I was 16.
Isadora Rudolph is a lifelong resident of Basel, which sits along the Rhine River. She works for the city's tourism office and says during a recent trip to one of the beaches where people hop into the river, she noticed an uptick in visitors. That's probably due to viral videos posted to apps like TikTok.
I heard lots of different languages lately.
It's appealing for tourists and residents alike, not only for the novelty, Rudolph says, but because it feels good.
It's easy, it's free, and it's really refreshing. So you have a kind of a small wellness treatment because the water is refreshing, the floating down. It's hard to explain that if you haven't done it yourself.
It's such a silly, giggly thing. Like, you just can't believe that you're floating through a city center.
Ella Foote is the editor of Outdoor Swimming magazine and penned an essay trying to explain the experience for people who haven't done it themselves. She says during the summer, when the heat is bearing down, the water's comfortable. Before you hop in, you can buy or rent one of the waterproof floaty bags. And because rivers only flow in one direction, you walk or tram it when you're headed home, maybe grabbing a beer along the way. The whole process, Foote says, isn't just restorative, it's also social.
Everyone's in this kind of pure joy. Can you believe we're here? Like exchanging stories, information. And there's something about being in your bathing suit when you're close to being naked, where, you know, that can be quite vulnerable, but there's that shared experience. You're all in the same space. So people share stories, I believe, that they wouldn't share if you met them in a coffee shop.
According to Foote, the Swiss experience is a perfect example of what can happen when a government makes a concerted effort to make waterways accessible to the public.
The Swiss used to have terrible river quality, and you wouldn't have wanted to dip a toe, let alone sink your whole body into any of their rivers.
But in the 1980s, authorities built new wastewater systems, installed concrete steps, and began posting public swimming guidelines and maps all around the country's river cities.
And now they've become these sort of pleasure places, not only a place to kind of get places, but also a place for just pure joy, like jumping in and letting the river take you. They're really wonderful spaces.
Foote says she's hopeful with international interest in river commutes booming, other cities will launch their own efforts to clean up contaminated waterways. But for now, if floating to work is on your bucket list, it's best to save it for a trip to Switzerland, unless a bacterial infection happens to be on your list as well. For the world, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Russia's private military company, Wagner, has spent the last few years working with strongman leaders across West Africa and the Sahel region, military power for hire. It's been documented that human rights abuses against civilians are practically part of the job description for this group of mercenaries. Finally, it seems they've lost a customer. Wagner says it's pulling out of Mali. But that does not mean Russia's footprint on the African continent is shrinking. It is actually growing. Philip Obagi Jr. is a reporter based in Nigeria who has followed Wagner's activities across Africa. He's even been detained by the group at one point.
Not every word that comes out of the MOD, that's the Russian Ministry of Defense, should be taken hook, line, and sinker. When Yevgeny Prigozhin died in a plane crash, the Russian Ministry of Defense decided to take control of the operations of Russian paramilitaries in Africa, meaning that the Wagner Group was to be known as the African Corps under the supervision of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Prigozhin had been the founder and head of the Wagner Group.
That's correct. But for some reason, the Russian MOD decided to leave the Wagner brand in Mali and in other areas in Africa, like the Central African Republic, Burkina Faso, and Niger. They maintained the new name, which is the African Corps, but decided to leave the Wagner brand in Mali. Now, doesn't mean that they're operating as two separate groups. So what we are seeing now is Russia decided now to have the African Corps as the brand for operations in Mali. You know, over 80% of Wagner fighters actually work for the African Corps.
And why was this militia, the Wagner Group, in Mali and other parts of West Africa in the first place? And what, it sounds, will they continue to be doing there, just under a different name?
Okay, well, first of all, Russia wants to have its influence across Africa growing. Well, they were in the Central African Republic, where they tried in many ways to take control of gold and diamond mines across the country. And they succeeded in many ways because virtually over 70% of the gold and diamond mines went into the control of the Wagner Group and now currently the African Corps. Now, Russia has been trying to expand its influence operations across West Africa. In Mali, after the fall of democracy and when the military junta took power a couple of years back, Mali came under severe sanctions from the regional ECOWAS body and also the African Union. So they needed to have partners economically and politically, and Russia was willing to step in to replace the Western nations like France. So it was also important for the Malian government to have a stronger force that will help defeat jihadist insurgents that were ravaging the northeastern part.
So you might think that Russian operations in Africa are shrinking because the Wagner Group has pulled out, but actually you're saying they are expanding. I'm curious why. I mean, Russia is fighting a costly and human life-intensive war in Ukraine. Why double down on sending troops for hire to Africa?
Well, the most important thing for Russia is that they can make economic gains from Africa. Now, if you look at these countries, they have certain things in common, whether it's gold or oil. In Mozambique, it was the oil. In Sudan, it was the gold. In Libya, it was the oil. In Central African Republic, it's obviously the gold and diamonds. In Mali, it's the gold. In Niger, you have uranium, and the Russians are looking to tap into that resource. So you look at all this is what they can gain. And mind you, the Russians have faced lots of sanctions economically from the European Union. They are looking for other avenues where they can actually take resources. We've heard that $2.5 billion worth of gold have been siphoned from the Central African Republic by the Wagner Group, and this money is helping in Russia's war efforts in Ukraine. The other gain for Russia will be the political influence. Having more allies in Africa means you have you know, more countries backing your efforts, more support in the United Nations General Assembly and what have you. So they are also looking to expand.
Philip Obaju Jr. is a reporter based in Nigeria. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Dramatic scenes from Los Angeles have stunned people around the world with images of the police, military, and protesters in confrontation over immigration raids. It's reaction to controversial measures the Trump administration is taking to arrest and deport undocumented immigrants. We wanted to understand exactly how many people are being apprehended. So I spoke earlier to Muzaffer Chishti, a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute.
There's a clear pattern. The deportation machinery has not stopped in the month of May and into June. It started first with increased number of worksite enforcement at principally construction sites in many parts of the country. And in the beginning of this month, they have now escalated into the interior of the country, both as worksite raids and putting people in removal proceedings who are showing up for their check-ins with ICE, which they have been doing for years. So the numbers have gone up from which were hundreds at the end of April. And I think last week, 2 days in a row, they had notched up to about 2,600 a day.
And my understanding is that deportation flights, at least for the first several months of the Trump administration, were similar in number to under the Biden administration. But now there has been an uptick. So in addition to the increased talking about an immigration crackdown, it appears as though it has started to actually happen.
Well, the deportations under Biden were still higher than under Trump, too, but they were inching up. What has changed in the last 6 weeks or so are arrests. Arrests don't always equate deportations.
Okay.
Because after you arrest people, there's a process you have to go through to deport people. I don't think the numbers have caught up with the Biden administration on deportations as yet, but they are likely to do so.
So enforcement raids have been rising since winter. Deportations are now also increasing, but deportations are still fewer now than they were under Biden. Did I get that right?
At the peak of Biden administration, yes.
At the peak of deportations by the Biden administration.
Yes, and clearly less than the peak of Obama administration.
Right. The numbers that you cited, I think you said something like 2,600 immigrants arrested a day last week. How does that compare with the Trump administration's goals?
Well, the Trump administration wants 1 million people a year. That's the aspiration. So if you go to this level of arrests every day, then the arrests will reach that level. But again, to make it clear, just because you arrest people doesn't mean you're going to deport them at the same rate. So we'll have to see how many of them are actually put in court proceedings and how quickly those are and how many people are be able to put in detention facilities because those resources are limited. And how many of those people will be accepted by the countries to which they're deported? Because part of the deportation equation is that the countries to which they're being deported have to accept them.
Right. What accounts for this uptick?
I think there was a very concerted effort made to put much more pressure on ICE officers around the country to notch up the numbers. The Trump administration was disappointed by the arrests and the deportations in the first 4 months. And the president, it seems, who is obsessed about the mass deportation, was giving a signal to his entire administration that this is a priority. And once that gets communicated, every agency head thinks it's the paragraph one of your job description. And Stephen Miller, who is the president's deputy chief of staff, made the 3,000 number a target in a meeting with senior officials about 2 weeks ago. And I think that's when the numbers started getting to the level that we've seen in the last week or so.
Is who is being targeted by federal immigration agents for deportation changing at all?
There was a lot of public sentiment for the mass deportation, as we saw both in the election and in the polls. But the president and his deputies had in the past said that, look, we are really interested in deporting serious criminals. But that's not what's happening. I think people are being deported who have principally committed civil violations of immigration law.
Can you tell me anything more about who is being targeted by these raids? You know, country of origin, what parts of the country here in the U.S. or what industries folks work in?
So in the month of May, there were a number of worksite enforcements. ICE agents would show up at places of work. They happened to be predominantly construction facilities, which in many ways is understandable because in a crew, there are a large number of workers. And they happen to be outside generally. So when you're outside, it's more open space. In an open space, you don't necessarily need a warrant because it's a public space. Getting warrants to go into a workplace becomes problematic for ICE. So the rights of privacy are much less in a public space. That's why I believe some of the construction sites have been more a target. But they have been Florida, they have been in Tennessee, they have been in Minnesota. They were strangely quite predominant in the red states in the last month. Now the ground is shifting to Los Angeles in a deep blue city of the country.
Muzaffar Chishti is a senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. He's been speaking with us about the uptick in deportations and workplace raids by immigration officials in the U.S. over the past month. Italy's referendum to change some of its citizenship laws has failed because not enough people turned out to vote. The referendum included five different proposals that would have made it easier for immigrants and children born in Italy to foreigners to become citizens. They also would have boosted job protections. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni encouraged people to abstain from voting, so this result is seen as a political victory for her. Meloni's far-right government has taken a hardline approach on migrants and refugees, including more than 180,000 Ukrainian refugees who've arrived in Italy since 2022. Some of those refugees who end up in Rome get their medical care at a place called Samifo Medical Center in Rome. The facility specializes in treating migrants and refugees who've been through trauma. Reporter Angelo von Scheich from our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW, paid a visit and has this report.
It's quite crowded this Monday morning in the Samifo Center. People from all over the world are patiently waiting at the front office for their turn. Mondays are always busy, says founder Giancarlo Santone, as in the weekend the center is closed.
Abbiamo il cuore del Samifo, che è il front office dove ci sono mediatori e mediatrici.
This is the beating heart of Samifo, the front office with our cultural mediators who speak in total 27 languages. Most of them are from foreign descent: Iraq, Eritrea, Turkey, Afghanistan. These are the most important people here.
Santone is founder and director of Samifo, which claims to be Europe's only publicly funded medical center exclusively aimed at treating post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma among asylum seekers and refugees.
Everyone who comes here has a legal status. They have the documents to stay in Italy. A large part of them live in migrant centers in and around Rome and are sent here by the center managers. Besides that, there's a lot of word of mouth, as we are quite well known by now.
The center is relatively small. Besides the front office, there are two consultation rooms, one with a female doctor and one with a male doctor, a small waiting room, and Santone's own office. In addition, there's a special room for more delicate cases, and gynecologists and psychologists are available for victims of torture and violence. Until the war in Ukraine started, the center was mainly visited by men. Now the patients are 60% men and 40% women.
Eccolo, cominciamo.
Dr. Antonio Spina is calling the next patient. Svetlana from Ukraine pushes her 15-year-old daughter Valeria into the consultation room. Valeria has a congenital condition which confines her to a wheelchair. Svetlana tells Dr. Spina that Valeria was hit in the head with a basketball during gym class, and now she has a weird bump on the back of her neck. Cultural mediator Olga translates. Dr. Spina reassures Svetlana there's nothing to worry about. Mother and daughter are from the east of Ukraine, not far from Kharkiv. 3 years ago, Bambin Gesù, the Vatican's children's hospital, invited Valeria to come to Rome as it was impossible to continue her treatment in Ukraine due to the war. Svetlana is glad to be in Italy, but her thoughts are still in Ukraine.
My mother and my sister are still there, and the situation is difficult. There are still bombardments, and houses are destroyed. I'm scared for my family.
Antonio Spina has been involved with the SAMIFO project since the beginning, out of passion and commitment, he says.
Normally, patients at an Italian GP are much older, over 50. Most of my patients are between 25 and 45 years of age. There are a lot of cases of diabetes and hypertension due to the sudden change in diet. If you change from a rice-based diet in, for instance, Asia to a European diet, that causes problems, as the European diet has a higher glycemic index.
But it's not only physical problems Dr. Spina is facing.
We see a lot of post-traumatic stress caused by violence and torture. One out of five of my patients is a victim of torture, either in their country of origin or in transit countries like Libya.
One of the people seeking help for the psychological problems is John from Algeria.
I lost my wife.
John tells me that he had come to SAMIFO because he's really struggling mentally. His wife died when they were trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea, and he has no idea whether his son is alive or not. He's still looking for him. It's a lot to cope with, and John is hoping that here he will be able to get advice. Perhaps even talk to someone who will know what to do.
Advice to know what to do.
The SAMIFO Center medics have been helping their patients for almost 20 years now. Over the last two decades, the amount of migrants reaching Italy has increased from around 22,000 a year in 2006 to more than 150,000 in 2023. But the little clinic in the center of Rome continues to offer people medical assistance, psychological help, and opportunities to get on with their life away from home. Other regions in central Italy start to see the benefits of a center like SAMIFO and thinking about copying the initiative. Angelo Vaschaik, Rome, Italy.
The vast majority of us will never know the high that comes with competing and winning at the Olympics. But those highs can also come with dramatic lows. Two Australian swimmers just spoke about this publicly. Kaylee McEwen and Molly O'Callaghan won medals in Paris last summer, and then very quickly they found themselves feeling isolated. McEwen told the Australian Associated Press she entered a really dark place after returning home. The World's Bianca Hillier reported on this phenomenon last summer after the Summer Games in Paris.
Christine Roper had high expectations when she arrived in Rio de Janeiro for the 2016 Summer Games. She rode in the women's eight for Team Canada.
We were heavy medal contenders given all of our past performances.
So we're away then in the A final in the women's eight, the biggest boat of all. It is
the team started strong and passed the halfway point in first place, but they faded in the second half and ended in fifth.
We raced our hearts out. Like, that's not lost on me. But when you've got the mindset of wanting to win and at the very least walk away with a medal, walking away with fifth place felt like an absolute heartbreak.
Roper returned home to Canada feeling disappointed, embarrassed, and unsure if she wanted to continue with the sport.
In all honesty, like, I was absolutely petrified of, like, putting in 4 years of hard work and training to just end up on the wrong side of the results again and feel that heartbreak. So I was very scared to keep going.
But she never wanted to wonder what if. So she set her sights on the next games in Tokyo. When that race finally came, everything clicked.
It's Canada who have led from the front in this Olympic final, coming to the line.
Roper and her team earned gold, an experience she remembers as exhausting, surreal, and the proudest she's ever been. This time around, she figured the following weeks and months would be a relative breeze.
I definitely thought, oh, we won this time. So I'm going to go home and it's going to be great. Like now I'm on cloud nine. And I got very rudely slapped in the face with the fact that that post-Olympic struggle is still there.
Her body and fitness levels were changing and she felt sad. And then she felt guilty for feeling sad. Sports psychologist Dr. Karen Howells says that's entirely normal. She's based in Wales and has researched what's called the post-Olympic blues for nearly a decade.
I have not met an Olympian who has not experienced it. And it's less about I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve, but more about now what?
Athletes dedicate years and possibly their whole lives to making an Olympic team. Christine Arthur, who competed in field hockey for New Zealand, struggled with her identity after not medaling at the 1992 games.
I was a hockey player, and if I'm not a hockey player, and I'm no good at being a hockey player, then what am I?
Arthur says in the early 90s, there were no mental health services available to her, nor was it common to open up to teammates.
You just didn't talk about it. Better to stay looking strong than admit that it wasn't okay.
Arthur herself is now dedicated to making sure Olympians and Paralympians don't have to go through what she went through. She's the head of performance life at High Performance Sports New Zealand, a body that works with the country's best athletes off the field of play.
This is about what was the impact on you and how does this change your perception, your goals and your dreams?
Rower Christine Roper says her team did provide her with a sports psychologist after the Olympics. Journaling also helped, and she continues to meet with a counselor today. Roper is now retired from the sport and works at the accounting firm Deloitte with a side hustle at a local gym.
So I'd say about a year and a half into retiring, I started to think, okay, maybe this feels a little bit more normal.
Sports psychologist Dr. Karen Howells says one of the best ways to prepare athletes for the post-Olympic come down is to tell them to expect it.
They're not going to feel great. You know, they're going to experience feelings of loss and depressive symptoms.
But in her experience, that can be easier said than done.
National governing bodies and coaches are not particularly keen on athletes' preparation for performance to be disrupted by somebody saying, well, when you come out the other side, it's going to be really, really difficult.
And even if a team does provide athletes with mental health specialists, Dr. Howell says some athletes don't feel comfortable opening up.
They felt if they disclosed to the team sports psychologist, the team sports psychologist would pass that information on to the team and that could affect selection, for example.
Dr. Howells adds that despite there being some remaining obstacles and stigma, the conversation around athletes' mental health is moving in the right direction. And the more people share their experiences now, the better prepared the next generation of Olympians will be. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Europe has seen early record-breaking heat this season. With climate change making heat the norm on the continent, Paris is adapting. It's expanding a network of pipes that pump cold water underground throughout the city. That's the topic of today's Big Fix, where we hear about how people are dealing with climate change. Raphael Nayral explains how the district cooling network works in Paris.
So the district cooling, basically you have chillers that will bring down the temperature of water down to 5 degrees Celsius and send this water through pipes. This water connects different buildings, approximately 850 in Paris. And then the building itself will collect the cold water and make it run through its different stories. And this way we'll bring air conditioning into the different floors.
So you said this is running through about 850 buildings right now. How much are you planning to expand this network?
We are planning to expand the network by approximately 3,000 clients by the end of 2042.
Wow.
We will expand the number because we want to also connect different kinds of buildings. Small businesses, hospitals, kindergartens, elderly homes, and so on and so forth.
So it sounds like adding on these hospitals, elder care homes, schools, is that kind of a public health approach to this expansion?
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, What is happening now is that with the climate change, cities like Paris will need to provide a safer environment for fragile people. It was more viewed as comfort service over the past decades, and now it is becoming a more sanitary matter for Paris.
So it's necessary for health, not just comfort. And why use this cooling network rather than just, you know, installing more air conditioning, which sounds like it might be a simpler approach?
From an energy point of view, we consider that the efficiency that we have in the network, you will consume half the energy that you would need if you were using a standalone solution.
It is a massive public works program, though, and I imagine it is not cheap. What are some of the hurdles that you have had to overcome to get this plan going, or that you anticipate seeing as you roll out this plan?
So, yes, there's a lot of hurdles to expand the network. It's complex in a city like Paris that is very dense, where you have all the different networks that have come before you, power cable, gas, fiber, they're all in the different little streets that we have in Paris. So when you have to install the district cooling, we have approximately half of the pipes that are installed into the sewer system.
So the pipes run through the underground sewers, so the work can happen there instead of ripping up the surface of the streets.
Absolutely, yeah.
You said that Paris has had this system for 30 years. How widespread are these types of district cooling systems around the world?
In Europe, I can tell you that we are almost the first one, if not the largest one. I think the Swedish has also have a big district cooling network. The biggest in terms of capacity are definitely the one you would find in the Emirates.
There are limits to all solutions. Are there impacts from climate change that this cooling system cannot address?
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, the perfect solution overall does not exist, and we cannot expand the capacity of the network to no limit. I mean, there's limit everywhere. But, I mean, it's not only what is the best air conditioning system. It's a wider approach. The city of Paris has decided to bring more trees into the city, to rehabilitate all the buildings, the public buildings, to encourage the consumer to decrease the energy consumption during the summer season. So it's all the different actions. And the last one is to use an air conditioning system. In that case, let's use the more efficient one.
Raphaël Nayral is the Secretary General of Fraîcheur de Paris. Eisen Hüttenstadt in eastern Germany was built to be a model communist city, but since the Berlin Wall came down, it struggled to stay relevant and occupied. Now the city council has a new plan to attract residents, the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Eisen Hüttenstadt had its moment in the spotlight 13 years ago. Tom Hanks was shooting a movie nearby, and he booked a private guided tour of the town. He was smitten and even gushed about it on Letterman, no less.
Eisen Hüttenstadt is an amazing architectural place where they're trying to rebuild it so that young and old people. Fascinating place. I love going there.
Eisen Hüttenstadt is a former East German model city created from scratch by the state. It's an hour and a half from Berlin by train.
A lot of cement, yep. A lot of building complex number one, and then we saw complex number two. Then we walked over to complex number three. And then guess where we went after that, Dave?
Going out on a limb here.
Eins, zwei, drei, vier. Yeah, we saw complex number vier.
The town was built in 1950 and called Stalintown. Seriously. The name was changed in 1961. It was created around a giant steel plant, and in its heyday, it had more than 50,000 residents. But after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the population plummeted, and the post-Tom Hanks boom never materialized. And so the town council is getting desperate. They're offering a free two-week stay in a furnished apartment in the city center. They're also throwing in a historical tour, a walkthrough of the steel factory, which is still operational but owned by a global company, all to give visitors a sense of what life would be like in an ex-socialist utopia.
So it had a theater, it had a movie house, it had dance halls, it had social clubs.
Justin Jampol is the founder of the Wende Museum of the Cold War in Culver City, California. He says Eisen Hüttenstadt was supposed to be a showcase for Marxist principles. It had big communal housing units and tons of green spaces to congregate.
For all of the families that had school-aged children, they put them within sight lines of their window or balcony to where the bus stop was so that they could watch their kids going down to the bus stop on their way to school.
That kind of thing is possible when you build a town from the ground up. Felix Winger is an anthropologist at Durham University in the UK. He says Eisenhüttenstadt and other centrally planned socialist cities like it might not be cool, but they're beautiful in their own way.
You know, life is very easy. It's well planned in many ways. You don't need far to get to the next kindergarten, school, restaurant, supermarket. You know, it's all within walking distance or cycling distance.
Okay, Winger says the architecture is kind of dystopian, but he says look around any modern U.S. city or travel out to the burbs, and you'll find developments no less monotonous and boring. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. And starting Monday, find our original reporting on YouTube. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.